Yo, what's up, everybody? It's another episode of Real Sankara Hours, your favorite Pan-African socialist political podcast. Today is January 28th, 2024. This is the first episode we've recorded in the new year, and it's actually been like, I think, 4 years since our...
Yes, very much so.
Yeah.
I remember very much being like, you know, we should start a podcast because I think 2020 election years are always kooky. And I was like, 2020 is going to be kooky. And
lo and behold,
this one seems like it's going to be equally kooky, though in much different ways.
Yeah. That's Peter M. Gunn and I'm Adam Hudson. Your host of Real Sankara Hours. Also check out our website, realsankarahours.org. That's where you can find all of our socials and stuff. You can find us, well, it's now called X, but Twitter, X, formerly known as Twitter, Instagram, our Patreon, patreon.com/realsankarahours. $5 a month, you get bonus episodes and bonus content. And that helps keep this podcast afloat. Because we're run by the supportive donors and patrons like you guys. So it's a great way to support independent Black media, especially during times like this. So anyway, that's pretty much it for housekeeping. RealSankaraHours.org. If you want to support us, go there. You can also make a one-time donation to us. We're not a nonprofit. We are a worker cooperative LLC. So, but anyway, it's been 4 years since we started Real Sankara Hours, and it does feel like, I mean, before we were recording, Peter, you were talking about is that song, right? The World's on Fire?
My world's on fire. How about yours? It's the way I like it, and I'll never get bored. R.I.P. to Steve Harwell. I still haven't gotten over that one. I guess we'll start at home and then get into the latest round of, you know, what is a genocide really?
We're going to talk about, a lot of stuff has happened, especially with, Israel's—it's not a war; it's a fucking genocide at this point. South Africa bringing a genocide case against Israel at the International Court of Justice, the ICJ. Yemen blocking international ships in the Red Sea, in solidarity with Gaza and the Palestinians. We're gonna talk about all that, but like, let's begin by some of the more recent stuff. Obviously, yeah, because this is another election year, so the primaries are already starting, and this is like 2020 part two, Biden versus Trump, and
hey, you can't count out Nikki Haley yet.
Yeah, I mean, that's true, we can't, but like, so Trump won Iowa and New Hampshire. Yeah, this does feel like 2020 part two now that I think about it. It really does, because it's like, especially since we started the podcast, like, it got down to Biden and Trump. So now we're getting a fucking repeat of it, post-lockdown, basically. This election seems boring and exciting at the same time. There's not that kind of like, this is the most important election of our lifetimes. It's more like people just seem incredibly tuned out, myself included. Because it's just like the choice is between Donald Trump, who has several charges against him, And he
91 felony count, felony yeah. charges.
Yeah. Yeah. Over 91 felony charges. I mean, there's a chance he could go to prison or he could be convicted before the election. So you have him running again. And then you have Joe Biden, who, and his support is dropping, especially among black voters. Like, and now there's still the, you know, the same fucking argument you hear on the left and among progressives that, yes, the Democrat is bad, but the Republican candidate is way worse. We have to vote for the Democrats for harm reduction, lesser two evils, yada, yada, yada. But you know what? That rings hollow when you have Joe Biden openly supporting a genocide, aiding and abetting Israel's genocide. Yeah, Peter, what are your thoughts on like the fucking Iowa and New Hampshire?
First of all, we need to hang one in the rafters, pour one out for our great friend Ron DeSantis, who ran in a magnificent campaign, but his ideas were just too far ahead of his time, and you know, the people, America just doesn't deserve great leadership like that. He spent $200 million for everyone to find out that he wears high heels and eats pudding with his fingers. Just incredible. And I guess because I still have like some sort of like recessive like election politics nerd gene, I'm like, I don't know. I think that Nikki Haley is going to be a problem for a little bit. She seems like she's got plenty of money, and I think they're just like holding on to her until, you know, to see how all these trials go out, break down. But also probably I think she's just running so that everyone knows who she is so she can run again. Like in 2028, I'm sure she'll have the whole thing sewed up. If the country makes it to then, which honestly, who even knows anymore? But yeah, it's just so funny that like there was a time in our lifetimes when like people got excited about elections. Yeah. It was like, oh, it's an election year. This is, you know, democracy. Isn't that fun? We get to pick the president. And now it's yeah. And now it's just like, oh my God. How long is this thing? Why can't it be over? Nobody like is really excited about this, like, and but I mean honestly, yeah, there's more of a curiosity because like Joe Biden really could have only won in 2020 because of the pandemic, so he couldn't really have to do that much campaigning, and people forget like he had no real functional campaign. He was eating shit through, you know, until South Carolina, then that was just like they, you know, Brock made the calls and you know, the fix was in. But yeah, like he's gonna have to actually campaign, and I don't know if he can do it. I honestly don't know how they're gonna make him like actually do campaigning events, because he's gone. Like his brain's not gonna get any better, and like the schedule like a campaigning president has to keep, it's just like, I mean, yeah, I guess morbid curiosity but I don't think there's a better representation of where America is at than this fucking rematch of one brain cell combined between the two of them. You know, that's why I think, like, you know, Nikki Haley could have like a good message of just like, I'm not 78. But the problem is like, no one wants her to be president either. So that's really the problem. But I think the scarier thing is basically like, you know, election years are like when the ruling class like does all of its deals and stuff. And there's a lot of violence that goes into like maintaining a facade of normality, as we all know. And I just feel like because, I don't know, I feel like it's just going to get even weirder and like way more dumb, terrible shit's going to happen. You know, I assume once the summer hits, you know, next time someone gets video of a police officer shooting someone, alongside like every, all the other, political instability, it's just, it's the kind of thing where you really have to like, work to not retreat into a hole because of how, just how utterly terrible it is.
Yeah, like my take on the primaries is, well, aside from Biden's explicit support for Israel's genocide, I find it hard to, well, actually, wait, hold on. Let me put it this way. Cause I've to go back to my point about, the whole lesser two evils argument, why doesn't, it rings far more hollow now than it did in previous years, is that, you know, you can point to Biden's record and say like, okay, like he's definitely marginally better than Trump, on certain issues, particularly like when it comes to, I think probably his most significant achievement was his infrastructure bill, which got watered down in the Senate thanks to Joe Manchin. But, you know, it seemed like he tried to do something or tried to include stuff in the infrastructure bill when it came to climate change. And but the thing is that when you look at Joe Biden, I think the narrative, because really, you know, when people pay attention to politics, like most people, you know, those who aren't like super political nerds like us and others, most people, like when they look at politics, they're not looking at it like that into that much like depth. Like they're not, most people are not doing like a real granular analysis of each candidate's policy, right? Most of how people vote is through narrative. And the narrative politically in this election, I think, is that for Trump, I don't think that sort of MAGA thing that he ran on in 2016 and 2020, I don't think it has as much appeal now as it did back in those years. He obviously still has a very, very strong base because he's built up this cult of personality. But, you know, I think when it comes to right-leaning independents, I don't know if he has them in the pocket like right now. You know, I don't think it's absolutely certain that he's gonna win over like some moderates or independents who are right-leaning as much as he did, like particularly back in 2016.
Yeah, he's not gonna, like, the suburbs that flipped, I don't think he's gonna get them back.
No, I don't think so. And, like, the people who are going to vote for Trump are, like, his really, you know, hardcore base. And then when it comes to the GOP elites, right, the donor class, the ones who run the GOP, they don't want Trump because they don't want another January 6th. Like, I don't think the Republican elite wants, you know, the people who did January 6th to control the party, because they still want a competent figure to run the oligarchy, to run the corporate machine, to run the empire. And they don't want a bunch of like fucking MAGA shutheads and yahoos taking control of the empire. So, I don't think the GOP elite, like, I think, you know, their attitude toward Trump is like, okay, we can use him to you know, do what we want, but we don't want to empower that sort of like cracker MAGA chud Yahoo base. So that's for Trump. I think that's where he's at. Now, when it comes to Biden, I think the narrative, and not even, it's not even just a narrative, I think it's just true. When people see Biden, they just see a senile old fucking fool who is, they see, Joe Biden is somebody who should be in a hospice care center at this point in his life. He's clearly just losing his marbles. And as somebody from California, my fucking senator, Dianne Feinstein, died in office at the age of 90. So this is where we're at. Like, when you look at the people who run the Democratic Party and even the Republican Party, there's that one video of Mitch McConnell where he like fucking just zoned out and had to reboot and shit. Like, these are the people who are running our fucking country. A bunch of like senile 80-year-old motherfuckers who, like, one is,
they, one they don't, they,
why the fuck they're not retiring at this point. They're just holding on desperately, like, we have to hang on to power even though we're 83 fucking years old. We gotta hang on to power and keep support. And it's like, okay. Yeah, they are so desperate to hang on to fucking power. They don't want to retire. I mean, it's funny, like, they don't want the American dream where, like, you could retire at age 65 and just live your life and just go to fucking casinos and listen to Jimmy Buffett and shit. They want to keep hanging on to this fucking thing until they die in office, like fucking
Dianne Feinstein. And the country dies with it. I mean,
yeah,
like, this is an ossified political class, and it just, their behavior, especially when it, with regards to what Israel is doing, just proves like how horrendously out of touch with reality they are. They really do think that it's still the 90s, that America can do whatever it wants, and, you know, America's best friend can also do whatever it wants, and the rest of the world just has to take it. And it's gonna be a hard lesson for them to learn, and I can only hope that it's learned sufficiently enough that all those motherfuckers are cleared out. Because, like, this is, like, even from an empire perspective, like, this foreign policy is just not helpful for that either, right? So, yeah, I think, like I said, you know, the fact that, like, he has to, like, actually run a campaign, he has to actually get out there and do events, and every single one of them is probably going to be and should be disrupted. And, you know, it's great because you get to see who the real libs are. I mean, very much like the image of, you know, the people that chant 4 more years whenever he gets interrupted by a pro-Palestine protester are like those people. We can't share a party with those people, like, you know. And so I hope that this is, like, I think a lot of the left, like, there is a, I mean, for me, it's like, you know, I've never felt more confident about being, like, breaking with the party completely, because he has to pay political consequences for it. And Trump isn't like worse in really any sense of the measure on Palestine, like, not at all. And if anything, it honestly, just going by like the last 8 years, like, in actuality, it seems like Trump is less chaotic on the world stage. It seems, because, you know, he's obviously like a narcissistic psychopath, but he's not quite as bloodthirsty as Biden is, I feel like. And people might disagree with that, and that's fine. But, like, Trump didn't start wars, you know, and he, like, is he cares more about himself than he does about the Empire. So, like, I'm not saying he's good or anything like that. I just don't see the actual argument as to, like, why he would be worse, like, on an international level than, like, what Biden has actually done, you know, with the Ukraine situation, with Israel, and, like, everything else. Like, he's really, like, by trying to replicate the 90s, he's, like, made America less secure and less safe. And it's, like, with the Yemen thing, it's, like, if the point is to, like, protect commerce, like, then engaging in an open-ended military campaign in the Red Sea, like, that doesn't stop that, like, that, like, that's just continuing to, you know, route, that's continuing to make the shipping lane not safe. And they literally asked him about it, and he was like, is it working? No. Will it continue? Yes. And so that's where we are. But yeah, like, yeah, I guess we should go to the ICJ ruling.
Yeah, yes, yeah, I think that's a good segue to the ICJ ruling. So, okay, I have a copy of it. Well, I have a copy of South Africa's case. So South Africa brought a case to the ICJ, and actually just to basically explain this for people about the International Court of Justice versus the International Criminal Court. There are two international legal courts. There is the International Criminal Court, the ICC, and then the International Court of Justice, the ICJ. The ICC, International Criminal Court, that has can hear cases for individuals who are responsible for war crimes and crimes against humanity and genocide. The ICJ, the International Court of Justice, where South Africa brought its genocide case, that can hear cases between states, nation states. So South Africa filed a case of genocide against Israel, because both countries are party to the Genocide Convention, based the UN Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. That convention, actually, that treaty, it's an international treaty that dates back to December 11th, 1946. I'll read a couple of the articles of the actual treaty just to get folks on the same page. So Article 1 says, the contracting parties confirm that genocide, whether committed in time of peace or in time of war, is a crime under international law which they undertake to prevent and to punish. Article 2, in the present convention, genocide means any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy in whole or in part national, ethnic, racial, or religious group as such. A, killing members of the group. B, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group. C, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction or in part. D, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. E, forcibly transferring children to the group of the group to another group. And then Article 3, the following acts shall be punishable. Genocide, conspiracy to commit genocide, direct and public incitement to commit genocide, attempt to commit genocide, and complicity in genocide. So that's what, this is a couple of the articles in the UN Convention Against Genocide. And I read much of South Africa's genocide case. It's pretty long, but it's pretty well organized. Like a lot of, like, you know, these legal things, they have like the, you know, section this and this part and this da 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 da. So the case is organized is actually fairly easy to follow. So basically, the South Africa case, I'm looking at it right now, and it lists like several basically actions of Israel that Israel's committing against Palestinians to support its case that Israel's committing genocide. So it talks about the killing of Palestinians in Gaza. So I think at this point, I think nearly 30,000 Palestinians, like definitely over 20,000 Palestinians have been killed by Israel so far. So the killing of Palestinians in Gaza, that's one. Then two is causing serious bodily and mental harm to Palestinians in Gaza. Three, mass expulsion from homes and displacement of Palestinians in Gaza. And keep in mind, like, Israel would announce these evacuation orders, but then, like, they would prevent Palestinians from evacuating. Four, deprivation of access to adequate food and water to Palestinians in Gaza. It keeps going. Five, deprivation of access to adequate shelter, clothes, hygiene, and sanitation to Palestinians in Gaza. Six, deprivation of adequate medical assistance to Palestinians in Gaza. Again, this is South Africa's genocide case against Israel. Seven, destruction of Palestinian life in Gaza. So basically Israel destroying hospitals, schools, mosques, bakeries, water pipes, sewage, and electricity networks, which basically makes Palestinian life in Gaza impossible. And this, they're also quoting 15 UN special rapporteurs and 21 members of the UN United Nations working groups. They were quoted as saying in November 2023, they were warning of a genocide in the making of in Gaza. Eight, imposing measures intended to prevent Palestinian births. And that actually, when I was reading the Genocide Convention, in Article 2, it said, Article 2, Section D, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. So South Africa is, you know, that's one of the points that it makes. Then it mentions expressions of genocidal intent against Palestinians by Israeli state officials. So it quotes a number of people who basically explicitly announced like their intent to commit genocide. One of the points I found compelling the destruction of Palestinian life in Gaza. Just basically Israel destroying like marketplaces, shops, schools, family homes, doctor clinics, even bombing registries where like people's, you know, their property deeds are located. Like all the things that make up just daily life in any society, Israel has destroyed. And I thought like that point is really compelling to show that this is a genocide. This is not about the hostages. Israel does not give a fuck about their own hostages.
The only hostages that have been returned have been through negotiations. Otherwise, the closest Israel's come is like literally killing them.
And anyway, so a couple days ago, the ICJ issued its ruling, and it basically ruled that that South Africa's case is legitimate. And so the ICJ ordered Israel to take all measures within its power to prevent acts that could amount to genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. So it did not explicitly demand a ceasefire. And that's been criticized by some people on the left and some advocates of Palestinians. But I think I was reading some Ali Abanima of Electrona Intifada. I think he said this on Twitter or somewhere else that the framework of demanding a ceasefire assumes that this is a war, and which it's not. This is a genocide, that's an important distinction and raises the stakes because, a ceasefire assumes that there are two armies fighting against each other and to end hostilities, there would be a ceasefire between two equal armed parties. And that is not the case here. Israel's committing a genocide. And so the right thing to do is to stop committing genocide. So the ICJ ordering Israel to take all measures to prevent acts of genocide, I think that's actually the right call. So some might agree or disagree, but I actually think that this ICJ ruling is a good thing. It's a step forward. Now, obviously, you know, it doesn't have much of an enforcement mechanism, but the fact that, like, one of the highest courts in the world is basically saying, well, accepting South Africa's case is legitimate and that there is jurisdiction, like, it's acknowledging that there's a plausible risk of genocide. So that raised the stakes. So then it means, like, okay, well, if that's the case, if the ICJ is saying, yeah, there's a risk of Israel committing genocide and it should take all measures to stop it, then that means the United States, President Joe Biden, the so-called upholders of the rules-based international order, that means the U.S. is supporting genocide. So it can't, like, say to the world that, yes, we're here to support the rules-based international order. Well, you can't announce to the world
that genocide's against the rules, it turns out.
Right, exactly. Like, I mean, no shit. It's so. Anyway, yeah, that's pretty much my take. I think this ICJ ruling is, I think it's a step. I think it's a good thing. But the thing is that I think some people who are probably dismayed at this ruling, I think, expected too much of the ICJ going into this, because it doesn't have. It's a court. Any court, domestic or like national, international, like, they don't have armies. You know, like, courts don't have, like, I mean, if you, when a judge rules something, like, a judge doesn't have like an army. Like, I mean, they can probably, you know, allow the police to carry out an order, but
it is literally their opinion.
Exactly. Yeah,
but it's also not done. So
yeah,
I think also an important thing that I saw on Al Jazeera that I was watching last night is that it doesn't literally call for a ceasefire, but it functionally does, because
yeah,
what the clear steps that, like, it are outlined that Israel has to take to not do genocide. Basically, they can't continue their operation while actually complying with the court's ruling. And they have a month to basically prove that they've followed up on what they've been ordered to do. And so we'll see what happens in a month. And then almost immediately after Israel got told to stop doing genocide, they had the brilliant thing. And this is like another instance where I'm like, Jesus Christ, everybody running this shit are like psychopathic idiots, because now Israel is running with, you know, getting the funding pulled for the UN Relief Works Association, which is sort of like the main sort of administer of aid in Palestine, and especially Gaza. Like, it was created to assist, you know, the Palestinian refugees, like, going back to the Nakba. And, you know, I'm not even going to, like, dignify what Israel's accusations are, because, like, it doesn't make any fucking sense. Other than they are just lashing out at the UN. They're trying to punish the UN. But it's just, like, you're just doing, you're following it up with, like, that's something that I didn't even think they were going to do, much less that, like, eight, you know, like, the fucking G7 would all be like, yeah, we're gonna, pause funding for the UNRWA. Like, you know, the UNRWA employs 13,000 people, and it, like, is the main, it's the main administrator of aid. And, like, Israel, I believe, you know, they've killed plenty of UNRWA workers. Like, That's like their second favorite target behind journalists, are workers for the relief works agency. And, you know, you see the videos of them like literally firing on, you know, the truck convoys or people lining up to get aid from the trucks. Like, you know, and these are like, oh, this is the aid, you know, Israel allows in 20 trucks a day for 2 million fucking people. Like, come on. You know, this is just absurd. And, you know, it's like, it is, as we were saying earlier, like, it is bewildering because, on the one hand, like, I'm not shocked that the U.S. is going along with this in any way, because it's just a continuation of its previously existing policy. But it is so just, like, especially, you know, the amount they were, like, the after all the sanctimony over Ukraine, which, you know, we've completely forgotten about. After all that sanctimony and everything, because, you know, Russia found itself on the wrong side of international law, to then just turn around immediately and just disregard all of it, is, like, it makes the, like, it does make the U.S. look bad. And more to the point, like, if America wants to maintain a position of leadership in prestige, you know, which is what all the Beltway motherfuckers, that's all they care about, is America maintaining its prestige, then, like, following Israel, you know, down this, you know, path of, like, it's gonna take America down with it. And, like, this is, like, the best evidence of this is, like, the campaign in Yemen that it has now started, which is, like, I don't know. I mean, you want to talk, you want to sort of intro that?
Yeah, actually, before we segue into Yemen, just a couple things, at least just on the ICJ ruling. Yeah, just to clarify, this is an interim ruling. And I actually wanted to, Al Jazeera has a good article on what the provisional measures that the ICJ ordered, and then go to Yemen. Well, actually, Yemen is tied to this because Yemen's actions in the Red Sea are, like, in response to what Israel's doing. Yeah, there were six provisional measures that the ICJ ordered. These are all basically approved by a majority of the court, a majority of the 17 judges on the ICJ. The main dissenting judge, which is the judge from Uganda, and then obviously the Israeli judge dissented on one of them, dissented on four of the provisional measures, but voted with the rest of the court on two of them. So, here are the six measures. Israel must take all possible measures to protect acts as outlined in Article 2 of the 1948 Genocide Convention. Israel must assure its military does not carry out any of the above actions. Israel must prevent destruction of evidence of war crimes in Gaza and allow fact-finding missions access. Israel must submit a report on how it intends to deliver all of the above to the court within 1 month of the judgment. So for those measures, the Israeli and Ugandan judge voted against. The rest voted for. And those judges, by the way, are from the U.S., Russia, China, France, Australia, Brazil, Germany, India, Jamaica, Japan, Lebanon, Morocco, I believe Slovenia or Croatia, if I'm looking at the flag correctly. Somalia and South Africa. Then there's two other measures that the Israeli judge did not dissent on. Israel must prevent and punish incitement of genocidal acts. Israel must ensure the delivery of basic services and essential humanitarian aid to civilians. And again, the judge from Uganda dissented on that. So, yeah, these are the measures. So, basically, this is an interim ruling to basically order Israel to halt acts of genocide before it issues its final ruling, which could take like, I think, 2 or 3 years or something like that. But yeah, so, you know, the ICJ doesn't have like its own direct enforcement mechanism. So that's like a good segue to actually Yemen, because on November 19th, the Houthis in Yemen hijacked a commercial ship in the Red Sea and have attacked like more than two others with drones, missiles, speedboats. And so the Houthis are targeting Israeli-owned, flagged, and operated ships that are heading to Israeli ports. And why is this important? Well, when it comes to international shipping of goods, the Red Sea is a crucial choke point for international shipping, because there's, you know, there's the Red Sea and then the Suez Canal, and that goes into the Mediterranean. And that, you know, you can ship goods to Europe, Israel, and then into the Atlantic. So for, you know, Yemen, particularly the Houthis, to attack ships in the Red Sea, like that's putting some serious damage on international trade. And the message from Yemen, particularly the Houthis, is clear, is that they're doing this to basically protest, is basically in protest of Israel's actions in Gaza. So the question is, though, I think, like, for a lot of folks who are, you know, hearing about this, like, okay, well, who are the Houthis in Yemen and what's going on? Because the US and the UK and the West are saying, oh, the Houthis are backed by Iran. So the idea is that, like, this is some sort of dastardly thing from Iran. But the thing is that the Houthis are backed by Iran in the same way that Israel's backed by the United States. Like, Israel is still its own autonomous actor, but it receives a lot of support from the United States. So,
Arabs can't think independently. Everyone knows that.
Right.
You just got to read one of those books, one of those large, like, weighty tomes called Inside the Arab Mind, you know, to really yeah. understand them. You can't go by, like, what they say and what their actions are, that, because it doesn't work like that.
Yeah. There's a BBC article that I actually think is pretty good. It says, Yemen, why is the war there getting more violent? This is from April 2023, but I'm going to read a couple passages because I think it's good context to understand who the Houthis are in context of what's going on in the Red Sea. So in 2011, 2011, so during like the whole Arab Spring, a popular uprising in Yemen forced its long-standing authoritarian president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, to hand over power to his deputy, Abdurrabba Mansour Hadi. Okay, so Mansour Hadi, right. I'm sorry, I may have been butchered his first. I may have mispronounced his first name. However, the new president was overwhelmed with Yemen's economic problems and security problems, such as attacks by jihadists. Furthermore, most of Yemen's armed forces felt more loyalty to the ousted president than they did to Mr. Hadi. I'm going to pause right here. Like, if you read the book Dirty Wars by Jeremy Scahill, Ali Abdullah Saleh was worked with the United States' war on terror efforts. So he helped play a role in, like, basically using U.S. counterterrorism operations to go after, like, his own opponents in Yemen. So so that's important, particularly to understand about, like, the president in 2011 who was ousted, Ali Abdullah Saleh. So anyway, yeah, so a lot of Yemen's armed forces were more loyal to Saleh than to Mr. Hadi. So then the article continues. The Houthis took advantage of his weakness. Formerly known as Ansar Allah, Partisans of God, they championed Yemen's Zaydi Shia Muslim minority. In early 2014, they seized control of the Sada province in the north of the country and then captured the nation's capital, Sana'a, forcing President Hadi to flee abroad in March 2015. Yemen's neighbor Saudi Arabia was alarmed by the prospect of the Houthis taking control of Yemen, fearing it would become a satellite of Saudi Arabia's rival Iran. In March 2015, it and other Arab states began an air campaign aimed at ousting the Houthis and restoring Mr. Hadi's government. The coalition received logistical and intelligence support from the UK, from the US, UK, and France. I'm going to stop right there. Saudi Arabia has been receiving a lot more than like logistical and intelligence support. Like, it's been receiving like weapons from the US. So like, the US has for a long time has been like financing Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen. Okay, what's happened since then? In August 2015, coalition ground troops landed in the port city of Aden and drove the Houthis out of the south of Yemen. However, they could not dislodge them from Sana'a or the north of the country. Yemen's official government is now in Aden, while President Hadi himself is based in Saudi Arabia. The Houthis allied with the former president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, to form a political council to govern the area under their control. However, in December 2017, Saleh broke with the Houthis and called for his followers to fight them. Saleh was killed and the Houthis defeated his forces. In 2018, the Saleh loyalists joined the Saudi-led coalition. Together, they launched a major offensive against the Houthis to recapture the Red Sea city of Hodeidah. The port there is a principal lifeline for millions of Yemenis at the risk of famine. After 6 months of fierce fighting, the two sides agreed to a truce in the city. In 2021, the Houthis launched an attack in Marib, the government's last stronghold in the north and the center of an oil-rich province. Fighting escalated in March this year, that was 2023, across the province, forcing thousands of people to flee their homes. The Houthis have attacked targets in Saudi Arabia and the UAE with ballistic missiles and drones targeting sites including oil installations but also injuring civilians. Obviously, I mean, like, Saudis have done that as well. Saudi and U.S. officials have accused Iran of smuggling weapons such as drones to the Houthis in violation of a U.N. arms embargo. Iran has denied the allegation. The Saudi-led coalition has carried out thousands of airstrikes, which have killed tens of thousands of people, according to the U.N. These include double-tap attacks in which the first strike hits a group of enemy troops, and a second one hits the people who go to their rescue. The U.N. says both sides in the civil war may have committed war crimes. Both sides deny the allegation. In April 2022, the UN brokered a ceasefire between the Saudi-led coalition and Houthi rebels, though the sides failed to renew it 6 months later. However, they recently agreed to swap approximately 900 prisoners as a confidence measure, which it is hoped could lead to a permanent ceasefire. So the human costs, like 4.5 million people in Yemen, a seventh of the population, have been displaced, and 24.1 million, 80% of the population, are in need of humanitarian aid and protection. Like, there's been, Yemen suffered like one of the largest cholera outbreaks. 11,000 children have been killed or wounded. So this is what's been going on in Yemen, and those are the Houthis in context. So yeah, the Houthis have been attacking Israeli ships in the Red Sea, and yeah, in response, like, Biden and the U.S. launched airstrikes against the Houthis in Yemen to basically, like, you know, their justification is, hey, you guys are basically to protect ships and shipping containers.
To protect your Amazon Prime orders.
Yeah.
Is how it's been phrased. And, yeah, I mean, that article did not really go into just the sort of absolutely obscene levels of damage that Saudi Arabia has wrought on Yemen, you know, with our support, you know, very much so, you know, creating, you know, that was in many ways a genocidal act itself. But the thing is that, you know, it didn't destroy them. And this is we're talking generations of people who've grown up, like, with, you know, U.S. drone strikes and Saudi airstrikes. And, you know, these are people who don't have a lot to lose. And this is like, the kind of you know, thing where, like, a empire graveyard of empires type thing. Like, you do not want to be, like, all this is going to do is get the U.S. more and more involved, which is exactly what Israel wants. Israel wants to be able to do its genocide and, you know, be insulated from the consequences of its own actions, mainly in the form of, you know, Iran and Hezbollah and the Houthis, you know, the axis of resistance, as it is called. And so what they really want is America to get involved, to own this shit. And, like, regardless of, like, ethical concerns, and, you know, I'm saying even from, like, even if you are an imperialist, like, this is a terrible move. Like, to get, you know, because what was the first thing the U.S. did, like, on October 8th is send its aircraft carriers there, you know, right off the shore of Israel to be like, we're here, guys. We're here for whatever you need. And they're like, bet, we're going to find plenty for you to do. And, you know, there's still enough, like, straight up Dr. Strangelove types in the U.S. military who've been horned up for a war with Iran since 1979, since the revolution. They have been horned up so bad. And, like, many people have outlined, like, if the U.S. tries to invade Iran, how terribly that would go, because Iran is essentially like a fortress of a country surrounded by mountains on all sides. And, you know, what we're learning is that, you know, one thing I will say, like, a point of criticism I have with some of the other sort of commentary on the left is when they talk about sort of the horrendous discipline of the Israeli military, like, you would never do that in the U.S. military. I'm like, I'm sorry, guys.
Oh,
do we remember Iraq? Like, there was plenty of undisciplined activity. It's just that
Abu Ghraib, like,
yeah, I mean, you know, taking, like, helicopters to go to Burger King and then, like, just, I mean, like, all the shit that, like, the IDF TikTokers are doing, like, we did that in Iraq. We just didn't post it. But, like,
yeah, right.
A dude would film it with a camcorder and then bring it back and show his friends back home. But they just didn't post it on, I guess it would have been MySpace back then. But, you know, we, like, occupying a city, you know, you can cause a lot of problem with, you can cause a lot of destruction with missiles and bombs. But it doesn't, you know, it doesn't end. You have to actually, to take territory, you need ground troops. And to actually hold it, it's just like, it's not going to go well. But it really does seem like that just the sort of inertia of the thing is just going to pull the U.S. like deeper and deeper into this. Like, we have no way, or it's not that we don't have any way, it's just that the people in charge have no willingness to separate ourselves, separate the U.S. like from Israel in any capacity. And so, yes, like, we deserve to be on the hook for what we're actively aiding and abetting. And it's, you know, it's just gonna make the situation, it's gonna make politics at home more unstable. And even though it's, you know, that's why I'm saying, like, even though it seems like it's going to be the boring election, like, things are going to be just as kooky, though, in a different way, because just the inherent sort of political consequences of U.S. foreign policy, this time around, again, are going to just make the entire political environment much more unstable, because, you know, it sucks up brain power and it sucks up manpower and resources and prevents, you know, since October, like, all we've talked about on this podcast, like, you kind of can't talk about anything else if you talk about politics, you know, if you're in the media. And there's really, you know, Israel can put all the spin that it wants on stuff, but, you know, there's only after there's only so many ways you can ignore the truth, and so it's just like this is what Israel said they're doing. This is what they're doing. This is what they intend to keep doing. And it, you know, they, you know, the Biden administration really does think that, like, it clearly doesn't actually have a problem with what Israel is doing, but it, you know, it's worried that there are going to be political consequences, and they should be correct to be worried about that. But it also just once again reveals just how deeply stupid they think we are, because nobody, not even the most fucking MSNBC pilled, you know, like imperial Democrat, like, believes that, you know, we called again and we were like, hey, BB, like, we're serious this time. Please think about, like, maybe stopping doing, like, a little bit of the genocide. Like, we're really upset with you. You know, it makes it, like, and he's just like, run me my money, bitch. And that's like what's going to keep happening. And so I think if the U.S. is going to do anything, they might try to coup him. But they're certainly not, because they, like, the U.S. foreign policy, the blob, as they call it, the foreign policy establishment world think tank, industrial complex, whatever, it, like, just cannot imagine a world where Israel is not backed to the hilt in everything that it does. Like, it just, it, you know, and people will, like, bring up, like, oh, you know, like, Reagan or Bush, the first Bush, you know, would be willing to, like, talk tough, you know, and it's like, Biden doesn't even do that. Like, there were at least, you know, I mean, they were also, we shouldn't, like, romanticize Reagan or HW, like, they all were fully supportive of the Israeli occupation that's been going on the entire time. It's just that, like, Biden seems like he thinks it's like his moral duty to continue to eat shit on this. It makes him look bad. But they can't not do it. It is literally, you know, this is like imperialist realism, to borrow, you know, like the phrase of capitalist realism, where it's just like, even though the whole thing is, like, falling apart around them, like, they cannot comprehend a world that is in any way different than, like, the current one, even though the current one is massively unsustainable and is, like, dying, like, around us, you know? Like, this isn't, like, Israel is not going to get away with this. Like, they're not going to succeed at doing genocide. Like, you know, this is one thing that Zionists are like, well, you know, Israel's like the worst genocide ever. It's like, yeah, they are bad at it. You know, most genocides don't succeed, and they are bad at doing genocide. Like, these guys are goons, you know, they know how to commit atrocities. They're not, like, genocide takes a lot of work. You got to be disciplined, I guess. I don't know. But, like, they are bad at it, and they're not going to succeed in doing it. So, really, you know, which doesn't minimize any of the horrendous destruction that's currently taking place. But, like, you know, people, like, it is very easy to, you know, I think there are just too many people, and I think this is a big liberal thing. Like, the real shit libs are just, it is easier for them because, you know, like, we live in a country that was founded on doing a genocide. So I think they're just like, well, Israel gets its, you know, if you get genocided, then you get to do a genocide, I guess. It's how they think about it. But it's like, you guys don't have to go along with this. Like, nobody has to go along with this. You can just be like, no, I can't support a president that does this. And it doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter what Trump is saying or doing, because you're not supporting him either. You know, you can't, like, you know, I'm not gonna tell anyone how to vote necessarily, just because that can get pedantic, but, like, you don't, you don't have to. You don't have to support this. Like, you just, you don't. And I, you know, I think people are going to, we're finding out a lot about each other, you know, as a country. I think people are going to find out a lot about themselves if they really, you know, because you know, the movement, like, it can't stop. Like, there is no point in, you know, involving yourself in this at all if you're going to give up, like, now, you know, because Palestinians aren't giving up. They can't. So you can't. So, you know, like, we still have to agitate and organize about this. And I think, you know, as I've said before, the left, you know, we really need to come up with a way to, like, not let these kinds of people ever be in power ever again. Because they've shown that they're not capable. They're going to run the world off of a fucking cliff because they don't realize how much the world has changed from when they, you know, were in grad school 60 years ago.
Yeah. And also, I think, to piggyback off that point, I think there's something to be said about the world we're living in becoming more multipolar. And this isn't like, I'm not saying like, oh, like, you know, the world is going to be better when it's like, you know, Russia is a dominant. No, and I don't think the world's going to go in that. But basically, the, like, let's go from like me and you's lifetime, Peter. Like, we're in our mid-30s. I mean, so, like, when we were born, like, the Berlin Wall hadn't fell yet. So, for, like, our parents, for both you and me, definitely our late parents, you know, for much of their lives, it was shaped by the Cold War, right? The specter of the Cold War. But there was, like, a bipolar world where it's like the United States on one hand and then the Soviet Union on the other. That was like how the international order was defined, by the United States versus the Soviet Union. Then Berlin Wall falls in, I think it was, what was it, 91? Let me see. But yeah, because we were born in the late 80s, so like the Berlin Wall,
the Berlin Wall came down in 89, so I beat it by like 5 or 6 months.
Oh, okay.
But, yeah, the Soviet 89. Union collapsed in 91.
There we go. Okay, thank you, Peter. I appreciate that. Yeah, the Berlin Wall fell in 89, and the Soviet Union collapsed. Yeah, the Berlin Wall fell, yeah, November 9th, 1989. Then the Soviet Union collapsed in 91. So, we were born, like, at the end of the Cold War. And then after that, was basically the United States being the sole superpower with the Soviet Union collapsed. And so that was pretty much like the 90s and the 2000s with the war on terror. Like the world order was defined by the United States as the sole superpower. Which also meant that like the US could be like this sort of world policeman and sort of, you know, easily bully other countries. It's like, hey, you know, you need to, we're promoting human rights, and if you don't agree with our interpretation of human rights, we're gonna like shame you and blah 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 blah. But in recent years, other countries have been rising, and not just Russia and China, but in this case, with the ICJ ruling, South Africa, India, Brazil, countries in like the global South. So the world itself is becoming much more multipolar, where the U.S.'s kind of sole superpower role is declining, I think. And I think like what's going on in Palestine and the world reaction, I think it's showing that the world is becoming more multipolar. And how the U.S. responds to that is going to be interesting, because Biden is still holding on to this notion of the United States being the arbiter of like the rules-based international order. Well, if the ICJ is ruling that, hey, South Africa's case against Israel is legitimate and Israel is at risk of committing acts of genocide and these are the steps they should take to prevent genocide, and if the U.S. just keeps supporting Israel, then its moral claim as the promoter of human rights and freedom, like, it makes the United States look even more hypocritical. Along with, you know, in 2020, the whole world seeing George Floyd being murdered by a U.S. police officer. I think the days of, I guess you could say, Pax Americana, I think. We're entering a different phase, I think, in an international.
Yeah, well, we ruined the Pax Americana by starting a bunch of stupid fucking wars. Kind of hard to claim that America is unleashing an era, overseeing an era of peace and prosperity when it's like starting wars. And this is, you know, the problem is basically other, you know, in the 90s, like, because, you know, the U.S. was just the ones left holding the bag, other countries, and we had plenty of money to give around to, you know, buy off basically anyone we wanted. And they'd be like, all right, well, we'll go along with America because, you know, we don't like it, but that, you know, they can keep the global economy stable or whatever. Of course, then, you know, we took that position and then immediately did the Iraq War, which was probably, I think, the first thing where, in Russia especially, because they were just basically knocked out for the 90s, and that's sort of why they never did anything about Kosovo or any of the Yugoslavia stuff. You know, the Iraq War was like America announcing to the world, like, we're actually fucking insane. We're run by insane people. And Libya especially, actually, like, in the mind of Russia especially, watching sort of the Libya intervention happen from NATO, that was actually the thing that kind of caused Putin to come back and reassert himself on the world stage, because he had left, you know, he wasn't president from 2006 to 2012, but after the Libya intervention, which took Libya as, you know, one of the more stable, prosperous states in North Africa, and, you know, it is just completely destroyed now. That was sort of the impetus to be like, no, we can't, like, the world is actually not safer when you just let America do what it wants. And so, you know, obviously creating a different system of international governance is something that's very complicated and it takes a long time. And, you know, I'm not going to say that, like, the states involved are, you know, these wonderful governments either, but they realize out of their own interest that they're going to have to figure out a way to cooperate and work together, because America just, it can't, I mean, you know, you think about just the idiocy of American politics day in, day out, and then you are reminded that these are the people that get to tell the rest of the world how to live. And you're like, of course the rest of the world isn't going to let this go on like this. You know, and it's a long way down for America, you know, but the more that it does stupid shit like this, and the less it is able to actually, like, demonstrate leadership in any capacity. I mean, it's always like, oh, the importance of American leadership on the world. It's not fucking all it's leading is, you know, more death and destruction. It's not leading into prosperity. That's not the image America has, because this is what it's actually doing. This is who it's supporting, and you know its allies are causing regional instability, and, you know, doing genocide, and that's a bad look, obviously. And so I think, you know, something I kind of said on the solo one is that, you know, the Israeli-Palestine conflict, you kind of can see sort of the different currents of world history passing through it, you know, communism and then sort of the end of history. And we are definitely out of the end of history. History is back on. And I think that is probably what I think, especially is kind of like the boomer libs have a problem accepting, because, you know, it's like they're, you know, if you were born, grew up in the 50s and 60s, like that arc you have of America in your head, like it's perfect. It's just perfect. And they like can't understand that was just, you know, one period of history. One period in time, and that the world is going to look vastly different, you know, in the next 30 to 40 years, which isn't really, you know, I mean, that's kind of an obvious claim. Like, the world looks vastly different today than it did 40 years ago. And, you know, it just seems like the kind of decisions that America is making, it seems like it wants to hasten its retreat from this world stage. It's how it seems. It doesn't seem like it's doing anything that, you know, smartly will improve its imperial position. It seems like they are, you know, they're too bloodthirsty, or I think it's just these are just fucking idiots who don't have anything else to do other than to cause problems on the world. Like, I think, or maybe they're just mad. I think really what it is they're mad that other countries won't be quiet when with their opinions about America's actions. I think that's really what it is just like, because you can't say, you know, I mean, John Kirby can get out there and be like, South Africa's case is baseless, you know, but then you can't use the ICC. If you're throwing out international law, then you can't use it. Like, if you're going to step all over it and just disregard it for Israel, then like when it comes time to use it against Russia, it's not gonna work. And also, like, it is important to understand that there are a lot of laws on the books about American aid, military, you know, not being used for war crimes. And that's why the State Department is doing this, like, oh, we haven't looked into it. Yeah, because if you look into it, it'll be obvious that so it was doing war crimes, in which case, like, yeah, there are, you can be, they can be held criminally liable. Like, Americans can be held criminally liable for that because there are laws against it. And that's, you know, yeah, like, some of these people really fucking should be, you know, I'm not trying to be carceral, but, like, if the law is on, if there are laws about this shit, then, yeah, some of these people do need to be prosecuted as soon as they're out of office. Because that's exactly what they know, exactly what they're doing. And it's just that they're so stupid and they think we're so stupid that they think they can get away with it, but they're not. Like, you can't, like, it's important to sort of reiterate that they're not going to get away with this. And you know, so you shouldn't like lapse into despair and hopelessness, because this ain't it, and we don't know how this is gonna end. Nobody does, you know. This is history. You don't know how it's going to end. It gets made, so it's upon. It is, you know. It calls upon everybody to do their part to make it the way that's best for humanity.
Yeah, and actually, I think that's a good note to end. And yeah, let's not end on despair, because, you know, as bleak as things look and as like boring as this election looks, the fact that there are so many people in this country who are supporting Palestinians, I think is a good thing. Because I think that it's been heartening to see how many people who previously didn't pay attention to Israel-Palestine, and now that they can see images of Palestinians suffering and dying, I think the majority of the American population like supports at least a ceasefire and is not okay with this. And we're at an interesting point in American history where it almost seems like we're reaching a tipping point. But it's not, it's important to not fall into despair, and to just keep fighting the good fight because, if Palestinians can keep fighting, then so can we for a better world. And there's, I'll end on this note, even though this is an election year and I really don't care how people vote. Cause I live in California. Like my vote doesn't fucking matter. I don't plan on voting for anybody. Like in the last election, I didn't vote for anybody for president. I voted for other stuff on the ballot, but like when it came to president, I left it blank. And I think I'm going to do the same again. But California is solidly blue. Like my vote doesn't matter. If you're in a swing state and you want to vote for Biden, like I don't care. I understand where you're coming from. Like it makes sense. But regardless of how you vote, getting involved in some type of action or activism or community work is important, especially like labor organizing. I think yours truly, I'm in a union. I'm a union member. So get involved in a union, find some way to get politically involved, at the grassroots and local level. And, it's important to not fall into despair. The world can change. The world must change, especially for the survival of the human race. So, let's end on that note. Don't end on despair, which I think is it's different than our other episodes. But yeah, like
I feel like we, I don't know, maybe it's 50-50. We usually try to have some uplift.
Yeah.
I'll just say this because I was watching football today and I saw a commercial I'd never seen before, and it was literally from the oil industry, and it was a commercial about how, you know, without oil and gas, like, hospitals wouldn't work. You ever think about that? And I was like, they really feel the need to make a commercial like this? Like, it is a literally a commercial for the fossil fuel industry. Like, it's not even for a particular company, just for the industry itself. And which is to say, these motherfuckers are scared. And they should be.
They should be.
And we don't have to take it. We don't have to shut up, and we don't have to take it, and we need to continue, through legal means, to make their lives hell and make them not be allowed anywhere near power, because their ossified, antiquated worldview is not going to last much longer. Nope. And the only question is how much damage are they going to do on their way out?
Yeah. Yeah. And on that note, that's the end of this episode. Thank you guys so much for listening. Like I said, patreon.com/realsongcarhours, $5 a month gets you bonus episodes, and helps keep this podcast afloat. And go to realsongcarhours.org to find other places you can find us, like Twitter, Instagram, etc. Anyway, keep the faith.
And stay dangerous.
All right. Later, y'all.
Peace.